Please be seated.
Mr. Moore.
Your Honour. Good afternoon. Before the lunch break, you were tasked with some over the lunch break homework to test a scenario in terms of how your restricted discretionary activity rule would work. Have you had an opportunity to test that scenario?
I have. Well, I have done a lot of thinking. I'm not sure I've landed it, but yes, I have considered it.
Right, so I'd be interested to understand how the scenario plays through the framework that you've put forward. And it may well be that as a result of having done that test, you may have some changes or you've had some thoughts as to what might need to change. It would be useful to understand the current provisions through the lens of that scenario first before we jump to that step.
Okay.
So if we could step through that way. And it would be helpful perhaps if you could just repeat the assumptions or the underlying scenario that you've been using.
Okay. So the scenario, as I understand it, is a water permit that expires in 2024. And sometime between 2020 and 2024, they convert from border dike irrigation to spray irrigation, which uses less water. That's the scenario you're asking me to consider?
That uses less water at the time that the transition is made? So that 2020, say, or 2021 is we now are?
When they change from border dike to spray irrigation.
Yes.
Yes. And as I understand it, the potential problem is that the use of maximums and the historic use record would provide a maximum that is required for border dike irrigation, and that is much more water than is required for a spray irrigation system.
Well, that might be the case, or might the situation depend a little on, let's go back a step, at the point in time that the change takes place, no permits are required. Mm-hmm. In terms of the change.
Yes.
So it's only on re-consenting under the RDA that an analysis would be conducted. So when assessing the rates and volumes of water to be taken on re-consenting in 2024, what analysis under your rule framework would take place? So you'd be looking at the water record right through to 2024?
Yes. Are we talking about the restricted discretion?
Yes.
Yes, 2024, yes.
So is it that the council ought to be looking at the volumes of water taken prior to the conversion or the volumes of water after the conversion? Or how does the council go about assessing whether the increased irrigation area is resulting in a more efficient use of water? Because that will have already happened.
Yes. So are you meaning the entry condition? I'm sorry, I am a bit confused about what part of the scenario you would like to test.
I guess I'm trying to understand what happens on reconsenting in that situation.
Yes.
If the full data record is able to be used up till the date of reconsenting.
The data record for water take?
Yes.
Yes. Well, the version that we've got in front of us after the JWS allows the use of the full record of data, which would include the highest amount that was taken in that record, which would be the border dike irrigation, say. Mm. And that would form one part of, that would form the envelope of the amount of water that the council can consider to be taken. And that discretion matter of discretion A limits the council's discretion to the amount of water within that envelope. That scenario can occur potentially under a controlled activity as well.
But the expansion of the irrigation area can't occur?
Correct.
So the expansion of the irrigation area can't do what?
Can't expand under the controlled activity.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to get an understanding of is the potential for, or how much expansion could potentially happen reliant on the previous maxima in terms of rate of take and volumes.
That would depend on the individual circumstances.
But it could be significant if you're thinking about the volumes used for flood irrigation and the transition to spray.
The amount of area, the area of land that could be irrigated, potentially.
Sorry, I've lost the thread. What could be significant? We've got, under the proposed RDA, now we have an increase in the irrigable area. So what could be significant?
The area of land which could be...
Oh, yeah, the area of land
yes.
could be. That could be. And so then what was your response to that? The area of land could be significant because there's no control on the area of land under your...
As an entry condition, no.
No, okay. All right, got it.
And then when it... So let's stay at 2024 on reconsenting. The full data record is reviewed, and it might well be that the new expanded irrigation operation is now occurring efficiently, but that entire area could be then reconsented under the RDA.
It could be, yes.
In fact, that's the outcome of the RDA as currently framed.
There is no discretion. There is no matter of discretion around area of land. That's correct. And likewise in the controlled activity, that's an entry condition, not a matter of discretion.
Right. So is there? Let's stay with the RDA. Entry
okay.
condition to the RDA. No restriction on irrigable area in this situation.
Correct, as long as that increase was already in play at 2020.
Yes. So if the applicants stepped through the criteria, taking into account our discussion on that, essentially the reconsenting in 2024 would be for the expanded irrigation area and the historic water use record would be right up till 2024?
Yes. And that would form the envelope of discretion.
Right, let's look at an example where you're shifting, say, not from border diking to spray, but from... let's say you're shifting from spray irrigation to dripper, so it's slightly more efficient, but not much.
I'm not sure of the difference in technical efficiency between those two.
Well, there's a range.
There would be. They're both quite efficient systems.
So yes.
Be close.
Well, for the purposes of the example, let's say the one that's shifted to is slightly more efficient, but not much. Additional water could be taken between 2020 and 2024. Provided it was within the terms of the consent?
Yes.
And then on reconsenting, the maximum amounts, volumes, rates, etc., used between 20 and 2024 would pick up on the maxima over that period?
Yes, that maxima would form the envelope of discretion. Yes.
Yes. So the increase in irrigation area, even though the efficiency of the system is improving, on reconsenting, it's not held to the volumes and rates used in 2020.
It's not held to that, no. the council has discretion over rates and volumes within that envelope.
But there's no policy guidance in relation to how that discretion should be exercised?
Not in PC 7, no. No.
Now, you mentioned you'd done some thinking in addition, so before I sit down, I wonder whether you might just explain where your thinking was at, in case I have another question about that.
I'm a bit nervous to do that now. I was considering the scenario that I understood Commissioner Edmonds to raise, where the envelope of water available is much higher than is actually needed for the new infrastructure, and was there sufficient discretion in the rule to allow the council to consider that and size the take to the need, if you will. I understood that to be my homework. So I considered that, and there is not an explicit matter of discretion in either the controlled activity or the RDA, because that scenario could occur in a controlled activity circumstance as well as it could in an RDA. And if if we wanted to have discretion over that, so to think, okay, this irrigation infrastructure that an individual has now requires less water than the one they had in 2019. Is there a matter of discretion that would allow the council to size the take to the new infrastructure? There isn't an explicit one, and if we wanted the council the explicit ability to do that, there would need to be a matter of discretion and control added around the efficiency of the existing infrastructure, sizing it to that.
And would there also need to be an adjustment made to the policy framework?
Yes, there would, because there isn't any discussion of efficiency. And I noted that there did used to be a matter of control around efficiency when the plan was notified, and that's since been taken out to make the rule more streamlined and simpler to navigate. So that would be the regulatory cost of adding in an efficiency consideration, is that it would make the rule more complicated and time-consuming to navigate.
Yes, and in fact that was tested during the early weeks of the hearing, in fact during week one, and it did create some other challenges in terms of the simplicity
it does,
of the
yes.
framework.
So. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Just before we move off to re-examination, you're not suggesting, or are you suggesting, that the efficiency, if you wanted to tie current irrigation use to a new and efficient system, but the period of record includes inefficient, an inefficient system, this question of efficiency is not tied to driving improvements in systems. It's tied to having what is, in fact, the water, the quantum of water which is needed for the current system, isn't it?
Yes.
And so in that sense, it may be easier than the former proposition, which was tested in the first few weeks. Yeah.
Could be. It wouldn't, because it wouldn't be driving people to upgrade their infrastructure.
No.
But it would still require an assessment of the crop in the ground, the efficiency of the system, which is all possible, but slightly more complicated than the controlled activity rule as it stands at the moment.
And that's only needed where there's a shift in a change in the efficiency of the irrigation system.
Yes, if the irrigation system has been upgraded at any time in the past, the record will potentially, by the use of maximums, outsize the water available to the requirements.
You want to ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
I just want to nail this. I'm not quite sure.
That might depend, though, if the previous water availability under the inefficient system was used as a platform to expand the irrigable area which stage the same volumes and rates might be being used over a larger footprint, but with a more efficient system?
That wasn't what I was addressing. Yeah, I was addressing a historic change that had already occurred, could lead to a water record analysis leading to the envelope being bigger than what the infrastructure actually needs.
Yes, but it will depend on a case by case as to whether the headroom created by the shift to a more efficient system is used to expand the irrigable area or not.
Yes. Well, in that scenario, it would not be a controlled activity anymore.
Well, if the expansion had occurred pre-2020, it would be.
Yes, it would. Yep. Mm. If it had already occurred. Yes. Every single scenario is going to be individual because some people don't have more land to irrigate.
Mm, sure.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just sizing the irrigation to the new crop that they have or a change. It's not always an expansion.
I think I'll leave it there.
OK, re-examination. Do you want to do your own... Oh, sorry. OK. You want to sit in this room?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. So it won't take very long. I actually just wanted to round off some questions in terms of the National Environmental Standard.
Yes.
Because I think it is important that we do understand completely the effectiveness of those provisions in Otago.
Yes.
So really it was just clauses 24 and 30... have the same set of words in them. So if we just look at clause 24,
mm-hmm.
which is in respect of subpart 2, the different types of agricultural intensification that are regulated by the NES, and 24.1 says that if you're in the discretionary category, consent may only be granted or may be granted only if the consent authority is satisfied that granting the consent will not result in an increase in, and then the two references to contaminants. So looking at the words that a discretionary consent may be granted only if X or Y, if an applicant, I'm actually just going to ask it openly, do you look at that as an entry condition to being a discretionary consent, or is that actually a default prohibited rule? I mean, how would you apply that particular clause if you came across it in practice?
Mm. I think it is... I wouldn't treat it as an entry condition.
You would not?
No, but you would be foolish to apply for the consent if you couldn't meet those requirements. But you could apply. But the council can only grant that consent if it is satisfied that those two conditions would be met. So it's a... it's a regulation that restricts the council's discretion to only grant in certain circumstances.
So in that sense, would you treat it as a default prohibition?
Mm.
Or is it, if you fall out of that category, are you just fall into an anonymate category?
Mm, good question. There's a few of those in this NES that it's not entirely clear where they go.
I guess it's helpful for us to understand where exactly how effective the NES is in controlling intensification.
Mm. I had assumed that the application's been made, the councillor's considering it, and if they're not satisfied those criteria, it meant they would decline the consent. So in that way, it almost operates as a de facto prohibition. Without using that activity classification.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. And the same set of words is used in the context of subpart 3 in respect of intensive winter grazing as well.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Right. So now I've just got some questions in respect of your evidence and Mr. Farrell's supplementary drafting. So first, if I just start with your supplementary. At your paragraph 5, under the subheading process or environmental, your observation is that there's a general congruence of opinion amongst the different planners that PC7 ought to be focused on matters of process, and that you consider that to be pragmatic. So I just want to test how much you have that opinion to the exclusion of there being an environmental element to the objective of Plan Change 7. Back in your evidence in chief, at your paragraph 12, that's where you talk about, whilst it doesn't give full effect to the NPS 2020, it should do so to the extent practicable.
Yeah.
And you use the good catchphrase, it's of it should hold the line on aspects of the NPS 2020 that will be implemented in the future. And then at your 19, in your evidence in chief, again, you acknowledge Te Mana o Te Wai and its relevance, and that it should be top of mind, is your phrase. And again, at 24, again, the term hold the line, and also in the third last line, that it should provide for the right direction of travel for resource management decisions, and not frustrate the NPSFM as soon as practicable.
Yes.
So, taking into account those aspects, isn't it correct that there are important aspects of Plan Change 7 that are not purely about process, and they do have an environmental objective?
Do you mean in Plan Change 7 as it was notified?
No, as it should be, or as we're working towards it being expressed in final form. So, for example, particularly when you talk about holding the line and correcting the direction of travel,
yes,
that both of those phrases are in terms of further environmental degradation, so it's holding the line, stopping further degradation associated with water take.
Yes.
And correcting the direction of travel in terms of environmental effects associated with water take.
Yes.
So if we look at Mr. Farrell's supplementary evidence and his redrafting of the objective, have you managed to get that?
Oh, I did, and now I can't find it. Is it in one of the?
It is in one of evidence? The bundles. Thank you.
Bundles.
Yep. If you turn to his appendix and then find objective 10A11.
Yes.
So Mr. Farrell's additions in blue refer to or add the environmental element of protecting the health and well-being of water bodies from further adverse effects from water abstraction activities. What's your view on the appropriateness of that as an expression of the environmental element of the Plan Change 7's objective?
I think some of the idea in here is good, to reflect a hold-the-line approach. Perhaps some of the language I would frame differently. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of principle, I think that's a sensible thing to reflect.
Yep, cool. Yes. Thank you, ma'am. No further questions.
Okay. Re-examination.
Thank you. Just a few questions for you. So over the past couple of days, we've talked a lot about Dr. Crystal's evidence, particularly paragraph 18. And today, yourself and Mr. Moore had a discussion on paragraph 18 of Dr. Crystal's evidence, which is essentially practices which could increase nutrient losses or contaminant losses to the environment.
Yes.
Within farming systems. And those were A, irrigation, B, effluent, basically the storage, management and application, C, cropping, and D, high stocking rates, E, fertilizer use. So there was a comment made, or sort of the acceptance yesterday, that irrigation can actually facilitate B through E, or go hand in hand, for example, more fertilizer use that goes with irrigation.
Yes.
So Dr. Crystal addressed ways to manage risk to the environment for irrigation in her evidence in chief and in the evidence yesterday, and we won't go through the various practices today because obviously you're not a farm systems expert. So if we go on to the second one, B, which is effluent, I was wondering from your understanding, where does one normally find effluent systems in a farm system?
Normally associated with a dairy farm, collecting the effluent from the milking shed platform, or of a system that has a feed pad or a wintering barn arrangement where the animals are confined and the effluent is collected.
So can I just direct you to some provisions of the National Environmental Standards for Fresh Water, provisions 9 to 14. Can you tell me what those provisions are intended to regulate? Sorry to do this to you.
9 to 14, got them. So those regulations cover feedlots and stock holding areas, so areas where cattle are held for long period, well, more than temporarily, so for a period of time.
Could that include loafing pads, feed pads, standoff pads? You might need to go to the definition section.
Yes, I think I probably will.
Otherwise, it might be one of those funny ones where they've got the actual definition within the actual provision.
I thought the evidence of your economist yesterday said that the contribution of dairy support to the total earnings made by the primary sector was some 36 million. That is 36 out of a billion.
Yes.
So the contribution of dairy support is very small. I don't think you're going to have any difficulty with the court accepting that there are some NES standards which might apply to dairy support.
Oh, no, sorry, Yona. No, that's not where I'm going with this.
Okay.
We do have systems within the dry stock sector which do use feed pads, for example, standoff pads to save their soils.
You mean you've got sheep and beef, not dairy support,
correct,
that are utilised?
It's now, dry stock.
Did anyone actually ask a question about this? And this, is this your right witness to be drawing that evidence
yes,
out?
Yes, Your Honour, because we're dealing with the questions that Mr. Moore asked earlier about
no,
the risks.
Hold on a sec. This, I don't think Mr. Moore has examined or tested this witness on her knowledge of use of feed pads and others.
This is of the NES regulation that
you
is...
You are trying to establish a factual basis.
Yes.
That is that sheep and beef farmers use feed pads for sheep and beef and not in addition to dairy support.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the correct witness to establish that fact? Because otherwise, yeah, it's a frolic and we can't go anywhere with it.
May I rephrase the question?
I'll ask the question. Do you have any knowledge of the farm management practices in relation to sheep and beef, and I suppose sheep including lambs and beef in Otago, and the use of farm lots. Do you have any detailed knowledge about that?
No, I don't.
So no, you may not ask the question.
Forgive me, Your Honour. I was trying to establish whether or not there was already restrictions within the NES to manage effluent.
Well, I know that there is.
Yes, yes, Your Honour. The question came up on whether or not the risk factors, the risky practices, were an issue in terms of the restricted discretionary activity or in terms of increasing your irrigation practices, increasing your irrigation areas.
You may not.
Okay.
You need an evidential foundation that sheep and beef farmers do indeed use feedlots and standoff pads as a standard part of their farm management systems, and you haven't put that in evidence.
Thank you.
All right. Any further re-examination?
Thank you. So I'd like to understand, you were asked earlier, what is cropping? Could that include pasture? And your response was, you believe that it could include pasture.
I don't know. Just
don't remember that story.
I think you're on dangerous ground here. You can't tell the witness what her response was.
Okay.
You can ask the question again if there's any doubt as to what her answer is, but don't give her answer for her. And I don't particularly recall the answer anyway.
My question was, with regards to cropping, I'd like to understand what cropping is to you, especially when you go back to the NES definition of annual forage crop.
I was exploring with the witness one of the notes to the reasonable demonstration of expansion of irrigable area when I asked the question about pasture. It wasn't in the context of cropping in terms of that part of the...
Have you got my hard copy of the units? I'm just having trouble looking into the system. David, can I have that? What's the provision that you want to? Don't give me the question, just give me the provision for you want to refer this witness to. It's a definition.
It's a definition of annual forage cropping.
Annual forage cropping. So is your question whether pasture is an annual forage crop or is it something different? Because, I mean, it would be a funny question given the definition.
My question was whether pasture was actually a crop. An annual forage crop is generally...
No, don't give the evidence.
Yes.
You shouldn't be doing that. So your question is pasture
a crop?
And the second question is pasture an annual forage crop, since you mentioned that? Correct?
Correct.
Right. So, first question, is pasture a crop?
Yes.
And is pasture an annual forage crop?
No.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. One of the issues that came up, as I've mentioned, was that irrigation and fertiliser use tend to go hand in hand.
I don't know that that's true. Why is that necessarily true?
When one irrigates, one can't just water one's plants, one also has to feed them if one wants the right amount of growth, generally speaking.
Again, it's a vast farming sector. Did you have a part of the industry in mind for making that statement?
No, Your Honour, that's just general gardening.
Oh, well, again, you're giving evidence.
Okay.
So your question is, do you accept as a universal principle that nutrients are applied when a farmer wishes to irrigate? That nutrients that in order to irrigate, there must also be a prior application of nutrients. as a universal practice across all farming types?
No, and I wouldn't have the expertise to answer that particular question, sorry.
Okay, thank you. The other provision which, or the other item which might increase the risk of contaminant loss to the environment, and which does sometimes go with irrigation use, as Dr. Crystal said, was high stocking rates. If you increase your feed, you can increase your stocking rates. So where you were speaking with Mr. Moore earlier, you were exploring provisions 9 through 14, 22, 26 through 29, and 34 and 35 of the National Environmental Standards. Outside of it, would you like me to list which ones those pertain to?
I don't know where you're going with your question.
I would like to know whether there were any restrictions, outside of these restrictions, whether she would be aware of how else there might be a way to increase stocking rates.
So beyond changing land use?
Changing land use, more dairy support, more fertiliser.
Beef fattening? I don't know. Again, is your the witnesses may not have expertise in farming systems, and so the witness may not be qualified to answer beyond dairy support what other farming systems might also see an increase in stocking rate. I would have thought that would be something, and of course here your economist has given evidence about this, something to do with the soil and topography and the capability, the natural capability of the land to support stocking, a stocking rate.
Yes.
Yeah. So beyond the general statements that we already have, and I had no difficulty with them from the economist, and particularly how he was addressing them, does this witness have any expert knowledge on stocking rates?
Ms. Ma, do you have any expert or do you have any expertise or knowledge of sheep and beef farming?
It's not within my professional area of expertise. I've got a working knowledge, having worked in the space for a while.
Thank you.
I'm not an expert in farm systems. Mm.
Thank you. One more question, which will hopefully be less annoying. You don't know how many farmers might or might not be affected by the plan with regards to those farmers who might have already started the process but not completed it, which you've been speaking about today. Mm-hmm. So there may be many or there may be none. What do you see as the potential risks in having the amendments you've sought if there are none?
I addressed that in my supplementary evidence, that if there are no farmers in the situation where they need to access the gateway, then it will never be used and does not create an additional risk or cost if it's never used. Okay. That was my supplementary evidence.
Thanks.
That is an amazing question, given the evidence before the court as to the investment and planning for investment, either before this notification of this plan and post the notification of the plan, including the Manaheda Care Irrigation Company. Is Sheep and Beef Farmers shareholders to that company? Just a question for you, you might know off the top of your head.
I believe so, Your Honour.
Right, okay. They'd all be in that category of planning for irrigation improvement and expansion, wouldn't they?
I imagine they might be.
So why did you ask the question if you knew that to be the case?
Your Honour, there's been a lot of discussion today and actually yesterday about the prospect of farmers potentially halting their plans for expansion as a result of this plan change, because the risk is quite
high. Yes, why did you ask the question? Given that what you know about the people who you represent and their shareholding in the Manaheda Irrigation Company and their interests of that company in these proceedings, why did you ask the question when it's unlikely to be zero?
Yes, Your Honour. I asked the question because we do not have these farmers appearing to confirm that they are indeed invested. Obviously, you are aware of this.
I'm not.
Of the Manuhirikia farmers?
I am not.
Oh, you're not.
Because we are going to be having representatives from that entity before the court.
Yes.
And many, many other farmers as well.
Yes. So, Your Honour, I was hoping that it might open an avenue to think about if the if farmers are given a pathway but choose not to take it, there is no risk involved for the environment or for the council in putting in the provision. Conversely, there is risk for the farmers, or at least difficulty for the farmers if there is none, if there is no pathway put in for them.
Right. Questions from the court. So I actually do have an interest in how this RDA rule applies to companies such as the Manuhirikia Irrigation Company, Cardrona and Arrow. And I was looking at, as well as any other, well, there's a whole myriad of permits which are out there about which the court has no, it's not visible to the court yet. So you've got your RDA rule, and you have provision AA. So the activity meets the entry conditions which are listed, and it is demonstrated that the increase in irrigation was planned in reasonable steps to implement that increase. I think there might be something wrong with the wording here. The demonstrated that the increase in irrigation... Do you mean the increase in irrigation area?
I do mean the increase in irrigation area.
The increase in irrigation area was planned and re-planned, and reasonable steps to implement that increase were taken prior to 30 June 2020. Would that describe the steps taken by Manuhirikia in preparing to replace their consents before the deemed permits expire in October this year?
I wouldn't imagine that it would include preparing consent applications.
The amount of work which we've told is substantial, we've no reason to not accept that. Substantial work has gone into preparing an application with technically more efficient irrigation infrastructure, as I understand the basic proposition, and secondly, may or may not involve an increase in irrigation area. Do you have any knowledge about that?
Not of that particular circumstance, no.
Is this provision intended to apply where a whole of catchment proposal is made and they are indeed substantial work has been undertaken to put into place improved technically efficient irrigation systems, and those steps are able to be demonstrated prior to, as of occurring prior to June 2020? Mm. Or did you have some other farmer that you were thinking about?
I wasn't, when I crafted this in my mind, was not big irrigation schemes.
Okay.
So I didn't draft it with those schemes in mind. I drafted it with, although it could apply to some of the schemes, where those people are working together to increase their efficiency and have made an investment in that. So they may have undertaken significant investigations into what kind of infrastructure is needed and how the water is going to be used and technical. In that circumstance where they have done a substantial amount of work, I think it is reasonable the council would see that as a demonstration that they had planned on doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for this RDA rule to work, they don't have to have... implemented it by the time their permit comes up for replacement. They simply have to demonstrate that the work was done to move now to a more technically efficient irrigation system and that also involves an increase in irrigation area. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because of the timing of these things, I don't think if people did have that plan prior to the plan being notified, they would have put it on hold until they are sure of the outcome of this. So, for example, you might have got to a certain point, saw the plan, said no more irrigation, and gone, okay, I won't proceed down that path until I've got more certainty about whether it will be approved.
Mm. And I'm not sure about your answer to that, because many farmers say, or many parties and also submitters say, we'll just reject this plan.
Mm.
And in that scenario, a rational response would be to continue planning for replacement consent, but under the operative plan, would it not be?
Well, that wouldn't be my advice to farmers.
Well, anyway.
But I can see why the uncertainty about the planning framework might cause people to push pause.
So for some people, might push pause. Mm. And for other people, they may just, because of the enormity and magnitude of the undertaking, particularly where you're looking at large-scale replacement consents in those scheme areas which are described as Arauca, Drono, Manahita, Kea, they may continue to work because of the degree of investment to date.
They may well have.
Yeah. So, again, because none of this is visible to the court, court doesn't understand how those catchments are made up and what applications might come forward, what permits exist even out there and how they are structured. I think you've answered yes. If you've got a... If I'm a farmer... If I'm just a single farmer with a shareholding interest in an irrigation company, and that irrigation company, together with many other shareholders, have been can demonstrate a significant investment in time and resources to improve, to replace existing infrastructure with a technically more efficient irrigation system, and secondly, that will result in an increase in irrigation area. That could be caught by your entry RDA condition.
Yes.
It doesn't require me to have implemented it, so this is work to come and would come on the replacement consent, is that right?
Yes.
And under that scenario, with no control over effects, this is just simply this would be a restricted discretionary activity with absolutely no consideration of effects.
No consideration of effects of the land use that follows.
Or even the water, no consideration of effects on land use and no consideration of associated effects on water quality, because the two go hand in hand, correct? Mm-hmm. And no consideration of water quantity other than what the entry conditions as you've proposed them allow.
Yes, so...
Wow, was that what you intended?
Well, this plan change deals with water takes, take and use. And none of the conditions deal with the subsequent land use effects of that take and use. This plan doesn't have that framework. So that framework is in place in Canterbury, for example, with the irrigation schemes. The take and use of water consents control the land use on the big irrigation schemes. This plan doesn't operate in that way. It has the effects of land use are dealt with as land use and discharge consents rather than water take and use consents. So none of the conditions in the controlled activity rule or in the restricted discretionary activity rule put controls on the land use that results.
But under what you propose here, could quite substantial entities have a water permit granted, propose a water permit as an RDA, as a standalone activity?
As a water permit? Yes.
Yes. Is that the outcome that you were thinking of, or were you thinking of a different scale of farming?
To be fair, I was thinking of a different scale of farming.
Yeah.
I was thinking about individuals rather than
like
schemes.
Mum and dad.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not, because they could be quite substantial indeed.
They can also.
And they could be shareholders in these irrigation schemes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what sort of, were you thinking of a scale of farming where there is, where the farmer also is a shareholder in an irrigation scheme or is not a shareholder in the irrigation scheme? In other words, the applicant has their own gallery, of their own bore, their own point of take off a river. And that's, yes, but what were you thinking of in terms of scale? I was going to say, but that could be quite large too.
Potentially.
Yes.
Although I do note that the number of sheep and beef schemes on sheep and beef farms on irrigation schemes is quite small, according to
how
Mr.
do you
Birds.
Know that? How many sheep and beef we've the advocate has just confirmed that there are sheep and beef shareholders on the Matahere Care scheme. Do you know that they're relatively
small? Well, that came from
small?
Mr. Burt's evidence of how many sheep and beef farmers are paying for irrigation to a scheme. Which he said was quite small. So the rest of the irrigated sheep and beef farms that have irrigation as part of their system are not paying fees to an irrigation company, so they are presumably individual takes rather than scheme takes. Sorry, I've actually, in saying that, forgotten the question. What did I have in mind? Was those individual farmers that have already taken a step towards improving the irrigation system, made an investment in it, that would be to the benefit of, there would be an efficiency benefit in terms of the amount of water taken to proceed finishing that task, putting in the more efficient irrigation system, rather than the plan as notified, which was a very firm no to consideration of those types of circumstances.
But I understand that's what you had in mind, but as drafted, the provision isn't limited to sheep and beef, and the minor proportion of land which might, on average, be given over to irrigation. It's drafted to potentially capturing anybody with an interest in irrigation, who any existing permit holder.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. It could do that.
And it could, and it's broad enough to capture any shareholder in any irrigation company.
Who was expending? Yes.
Yeah. Who was expending money with a view to improving technical efficiency and increasing land under irrigation? Okay. Question.
I just wanted to ask you what it was that you intended by two when you talk about the existing irrigation infrastructures being replaced with more technically efficient irrigation infrastructure, and people have talked about drippers and the means of delivery when you actually get the water to the point of delivery to the particular crop, for example, I think if cropping example, vineyards and cherries got mentioned. So
they do.
My question to you is, were you thinking of this in terms of a property scale thing where it was the whole shooting match was contained on the property, or were you thinking more broadly than that? Question one.
In terms of the irrigation infrastructure?
Yes, being existing the irrigation infrastructure. I'm going to ask you about situations that I'm fully aware of, which mean that the water's conveyed onto the property, ultimately often in leaky races and that kind of thing.
And what is
But I want to just to understand what you meant with the existing irrigation infrastructure. Was that everything on the property that related to irrigation, not just the drifters, but the delivery of the water, the take and the delivery of water?
Sure. What I had in mind there, the technical efficiency of the irrigation infrastructure, was the part that is doing the irrigating, not the conveyance system.
Not the take and the conveyance.
No.
No.
The reason I put that in there is so that the expanded irrigation area can't just be more border dike. It has to be a genuine efficiency gain, so it's using the same amount of water in a more efficient way than the existing system does, technically efficient way.
So you're not factoring in what may be happening with the take and the conveyance in terms of efficiency. If you've got a lot of evaporation and leakage and basically inefficient use of the resource.
Yes, it would be. I agree.
Whether that's on the property of the individual concerned or whether it's from outside of the property could be being conveyed over several properties.
It could be. Yes, and I understand there are a lot number of water races and canals that are delivering water in a quite complicated system. Yes. No, I was talking about the irrigation infrastructure itself for irrigating, not delivering water to irrigate.
Sorry, I was just following questions. Just to try and get a little bit of clarification.
Sure.
So, in fact, proportionately, who knows, there may be major inefficiencies as a result of having this irrigation in the first place, even if it's being efficiently delivered on the property.
Yes, there might be inefficiencies in the conveyancing system. That could absolutely be true.
Yes. And yes, okay. So we're only looking at part of the picture, really, potentially, here.
Yes.
And is this only, in effect, limited to where the irrigation systems improvement is a change from border diking and wild flooding? Or is it more than that? Yeah, well, that's actually all I can think of, so there goes my imagination. Tapped out at two. Because it can't be like K-line. It's not changing from K-line to some other, to a lateral, because K-line is an irrigation system delivering water, inefficiently, but delivering water. Mm. Was that what you had in mind?
So the irrigation systems range in efficiency from flood irrigation, border dike, all the way through up to very efficient dripper or spray irrigations. So the biggest change is going to be between wild flood and very efficient dripper. There could also be efficiency gains moving from K-line to spray or dripper irrigation. But there's probably not much more within that system.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think the evidence was 30% of the irrigation is border dike or wild flood. So there is a lot of efficiencies we can gain that could be gained within that by upgrading that infrastructure.
So you are thinking then, if I shift from a K-line through to a lateral, that I could be, that's what I've been planning on, that would be a qualifying change in the irrigation system.
If it's with the same amount of water. Assuming you're not using any more water than you were before.
And you don't know how much more land... You really don't have any knowledge in terms of how many people stand to take advantage of that if it came through in some shape or form.
No. Absolutely don't. have any knowledge of the scale.
Okay. Your question.
So I just wanted to explore a little bit more, I guess, drawing on your extensive experience. I wonder perhaps if we could just look at the controlled activity, the first matter that controls reserved two.
Yes.
And I just wanted to understand what you thought this might allow the council to actually do in terms of the decision it might make in terms of any conditions, what the basis of that might be.
So we're looking at controlled activity...
A.
Matter of control A.
A, so yes.
The council reserves control over the volume and rate of water taken, dam, discharged or diverted within the limits of historical use and existing permit conditions.
Yes, yes.
So it makes more sense to me when I turn it around.
Sure, no, well, I understand that. I know Mr. Moore did ask you some questions about that in relation to what you might be able to consider in terms of the MPSFM, but if we could just step back from that, because I will take you back to that. But
sure.
Could you just, you might even have a scenario you could, from your experience, that might, you think might fall within that or not fall within that?
Okay, I'll try to be helpful there. So there are entry conditions which mean that you can't apply for more water than the maximum rates and volumes that are calculated through the schedule.
Sure.
Which uses historic data to calculate what's been used. And the way that I've characterised in my thinking that we did in the conferencing was that historic use calculated through that schedule forms the envelope of the maximum amount of water that can be applied for. And then the council's got control, so they can impose conditions on the consent relating to the volume and rate of take within that envelope. So they can't go more than that. Could they go less than that? Potentially, that matter of control doesn't limit them to a minimum amount that would be granted, but because the person's applied for a consent for that certain amount of water, and the council has to grant the consent, they would have to exercise that control in a very narrow way. Otherwise, they would be frustrating the application, which they wouldn't be allowed to do.
So that narrow way, what would that allow consideration of? Effects? And what kind of effects? Effects on abstractors, in-stream values, other values?
I know that the intention has been that the council wouldn't consider that wider range of effects. For example, in-stream effects of the abstraction, because that would require assessments that take more time and are more complicated, and the goal of the controlled activity rule was to be a streamlined pathway to replace consents that were expiring.
Other abstractors?
Would potentially come in under B. As I understand it, there's sometimes conditions already on the consents about who can exercise a consent based on the effect that has on somebody else's consent. That's already a condition on the deemed permit, for example, then that could be rolled over under B.
So you want to get into deemed permits now?
No.
I'm just trying to understand the utility of that A and what it actually does in the end and what the council could do with it.
Mm.
The proposition is its only utility, to the extent that it has any utility, is if you don't put any bounds in time around the record that you can look at for data. So if there's no... So if all data is good data, then you'd need that condition to examine if there's been a change in efficiency in your irrigation system. Has there been a decrease, I guess, in the volume and rate of take, such that an old maxima pertaining to an old system, it just ceases to be relevant, and if you like, and farmers will cringe, but there's a lowering in terms of, a further lowering in terms of the cap for a deemed permit especially, but also any other replacement consent. Is that its utility?
Or might that be subject to argument?
I think possibly it would be, because if you've applied for 100 litres a second, to what extent can the matter of control change that, essentially change the nature of the application and only provide for 50 litres a second? Is that getting in the way of the requirement to actually grant the application? Does that make it a different application if the rate of take is much smaller than what was applied for? And I think that's probably quite a technical legal question, actually.
It's a planning question, though. How would you normally tackle that? So is there something deficient in either the controlled activity rule or alternatively even the RDA rule, your version or the council's version, it doesn't really matter. Is there a deficiency there where people are actually applying for maxima that are unrelated to the current irrigation system that actually has to be recognised somewhere, and so that the application's tied to the system, which is on the ground?
It doesn't.
If you wanted, I think if you wanted to specifically address that issue, you would have to add a matter of control in there about the efficiency and the need for the water based on the current infrastructure.
Yes. So that's what's missing.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And that might be a change that arises out of the change from using average maximums to maximums.
Thank
you. That's quite helpful. So just in terms of the... been similar issues with the restricted discretionary, but just thinking about trying to go up the tree to consider the NPS FM.
Yes.
Did I understand you to answer Mr. Moore to the effect that you didn't see that as being possible in the way that the restricted discretionary activity matters were structured? Is that what I understood you to say? We'll start with the restricted discretionary.
So if the... So, for example, there was an issue with a particular Indigenous fish value, for example, being potentially impacted. Does that matter of discretion allow you to consider that when you are deciding on the rates and volumes? To go back to the NPS for that, I think it is potentially easier to consider that in an RDA, because the council does have a little bit more. They have the discretion to decline the consent if it's considered necessary. To what extent does their discretion extend within the limits of historical use? it can't go beyond that, but can it reduce the rate and volume within the limits of historical use? And again, if you wanted to make that crystal clear, you would need to add further matters of discretion relating to, again, efficiency of the system, efficiency of the current system, so you're not applying for more water than you can actually use, and that isn't explicitly stated in there. And if it was an adverse effect, that's definitely not explicitly stated within there.
Or what type of adverse effect be considering,
yes.
Whether it's on in-stream fish or other abstractors or whatever.
That's right, and then it goes back to what extent is the plan change aimed at fixing problems, and to what extent is it aimed at not making more problems within that.
So the MPSFM has a lot of process things in it, doesn't it?
It does.
So even if you were to go back up the tree, how helpful do you think that might be in dealing with some of these issues?
In a consent application
perhaps
scenario?
In terms of the, we could think about the RDA one.
Yeah. In a assessing a resource consent, having regard to the MPS, I think is largely about the objectives and policies of the MPS rather than the implementation part, particularly the NOF and the setting environmental flows. Those are directions to the regional council to do things and change their plans rather than directions to consent decision makers. The direction to consent decision makers is largely the objective and policies in the MPS. Most of the other pages are about telling the council what they need to do in their regional plan.
And so how helpful are those other objectives then? The ones that aren't connected into the follow-up actions the council is to take?
Well, they are very helpful because they set priority. In particular, the health and wellbeing of the water body needs to be taken care of. And they identify particular matters with directive policy around protecting, for example, wetlands. Some of the policies are process. For example, tangata whenua being actively involved. That's more about the process rather than the outcome. But the other policies are pointing towards outcomes that the MPS is trying to achieve, and they are relevant considerations and resource consents to the extent that the matters of control or discretion allow that consideration.
Right, so we're coming back to what are these matters of discretion or control saying?
Yes.
And so just thinking about the policy element then in this plan change. So is there anything in there that's going to assist in terms of effects?
No.
No.
Not in PC7, no.
Not in PC7.
No.
Okay.
There are some other policies in the rest of the freshwater plan chain, land and water plan, that go to maintaining and taking care of particular values, but in PC7 it's very process oriented.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, so let's get into deemed permits. Did your advocate send you a copy of the minute that I released about deemed permits on the 7th of April?
I don't believe so. 7th of April.
Yep.
No, I haven't seen anything from the 7th of
April. Did you send a copy of that as directed? Do we have a copy on file that we can hand over? Thanks. So again, this is another It's a minute released about deemed permits. It's regrettable that you haven't seen it. It's courts looking for other blind spots, if you like, within PC 7, which are not addressed, need to be addressed, and is in the interests of all farmers that it is addressed. So deemed permits.
Okay.
I think Frieda should have a copy. We've got a cleanish. Well, we've got a copy that can be used. It's only been highlighted in terms of the title. I'm going to take a break, and I'll let you read that because it's reasonably complicated, and then I'm going to pick your brains.
Okay.
So it'll be well within your planning expertise.
To think about. Okay.
You can assist me, or you can't. It's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, not straightforward. In fact, it's horrendously complicated. But there we go.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Do your best.
All right. Thank you. We'll take a break.
Please all stand.